Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Martin Powers, who is Sally Michelson Davidson Professor of Chinese Arts and Cultures at the University of Michigan, and the recipient of numerous honors and awards for his scholarship on Chinese art history. Among his many important publications are two books, which both won the Joseph Levinson Prize for Best Book in Pre-20th Century Chinese Studies, Art and Political Expression in Early China, and Pattern and Person, Ornament, Society, and Self in Classical China. His new book, which is coming out this summer from Routledge, is titled China and England, the Pre-Industrial Struggle for Justice in Word and Image. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in Chinese art history?
Yeah, sure. Something might be a little unusual in my case is I grew up back of the yards in Chicago in a low-income neighborhood. My father was a plumber for the phone company. No one in my family had ever gone to college, but my high school teachers encouraged me to go to college, and I managed to do that. It was in high school, though, that I got interested in Chinese studies. In those days, you had these Dover editions of Asian classics, and I picked up a translation of Zhuangzi, the 4th century BCE philosopher. He was a radical then, and he's still radical now, and this book blew my mind, as they said in those days. And that got me interested in Chinese studies. At my history teacher's advice, high school history teacher's advice, I went to Scheimer College, which was a Hutchins-style great books system. I feel very fortunate to have done that. We read Plato, Aristotle, Marx, Weber, Jefferson, Rousseau, whatever, for 4 years. That's all we did. There were no textbooks. We read only primary sources. Wow. And this was a very good education. Scheimer's still around, I think, in Chicago. In any case, that prepared me for grad school, and I applied to the University of Chicago. I was accepted when I got there. They said, do you want to do East or West? I said, East. Do you want to do China or Japan? I said, China. They said, well, then you have to take the language. And I started taking the language, and I loved it. I just thought it seemed the most logical language in the world to me. Wow. I'd studied German, French, Latin, and this one seemed to make sense somehow. And that's how I got started. My first job was UCLA for 10 years. I got tenure there. Then Michigan invited me to apply for a position they had. I got that position, and I've been there for 30 years.
Wow.
And very happy. I'm very proud to be a faculty at the University of Michigan. The first book, Art and Political Expression, was unusual at the time. It's normal nowadays when you study art history to look at the social history and economic history and whatnot. But this was back in the 80s that I was writing the book, and it wasn't so usual then. I have two chapters on the economy and how much these works cost, and who's paying for it, and so on. Now all this is just standard stuff. Yeah. Back then it wasn't quite so standard. And that, as you say, won the Levinson Prize. And then I write slowly. So roughly every 10 years I put out a book. So the second one was on the even earlier period. That was about the origins of bureaucratic theory. In fact, both books deal a lot with administrative practice and theory. The second one dealt with the origins of bureaucratic theory and how it develops in China, basically, ironically, on the back of the earlier ritual system, but it ends up completely rejecting ritual, God, religion, anything like that. Wow. But they use many of the same terms. They just turn them around. This is normal in history, actually. Take the word class in English, which now refers basically to income groups, right? We have middle class, we got the wealthy, and so on. Originally, it meant an inherited social rank,
right?
And which is quite different from our current meaning.
Yeah.
But I've always been doing a largely administrative history, bureaucratic theory, and social history.
Wow. So it sounds like right from the beginning, you were interested in these very basic fundamental questions. I don't know if you'd call them timeless, but you know, not just a matter of kind of antiquarian looking back at a remote time, but these questions that keep coming up.
Yeah, I would call them perennial questions.
Perennial questions.
They're not exactly universal. They don't show up everywhere,
but they
show up again and again.
Yeah.
In many cultures.
That was very interesting to hear about your experience studying in the kind of great books approach, because I think many people might hear great books and think, oh, it's Western, it's Plato, it's Socrates, but it sounds like your interest in in China was very much combined with that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because while I was reading the great books, and especially once I got into grad school and started reading classical Chinese myself, I'm thinking, they have great books too.
Yeah.
They have some of the same ideas, you
right.
know, and so it's not just Western. Mm-hmm. And indeed, this has been kind of a frustration my whole life, trying to get this message out. Hey, guys, there's really interesting stuff over there to read and look at. And of course, more recently with the current project, the current book, I realized that what we call Western, some of it has Asian genetic material in it. And it, of course, everyone knows that China, since the 17th, 18th century, has incorporated things from Europe. We know that. So there's no pure Chinese culture, but there's no pure Western culture either.
Yeah, I'll come back to that in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you also, going back to your earlier work, in your first book, you looked at art of the first century in the Eastern Han Dynasty, specifically funerary art, the tombs of various important individuals and families. And some earlier Western scholars had judged this artwork on whether it was more or less naturalistic or realistic. Right. But you would say that's not an adequate explanation. So could you describe some of these murals a little bit and how you developed your interpretation of them?
Sure. First of all, the premise I work with, and I got this from my teacher at University of Chicago, Harry right. Vanderstop, and you don't judge style
right.
because it's always exactly what they wanted.
Yes.
You know, you get what they wanted, not
right.
what you want. And so you need to explain it. So if they're working in a relatively geometric style, we have to understand why they did that.
Right.
And so I went into this and, you know, these shrines and even the tombs to a lesser extent were public monuments that people could come and see, and people even wrote graffiti on them.
Wow.
And they expected that we have inscriptions which say, if you want to come and look at the pictures, that's fine, but don't write graffiti.
Right.
And so but these were not even middle class. I mean, some of these were just village level scholars. So for the first time in history, not just China, I think anywhere, they weren't exactly poor, but not wealthy people. We're not talking about Roman aristocrats, okay? People of a very middling status have the power of art in their hands, and they're using this for propaganda. And we know they did this. They would hang portraits of martyrs in post offices, for example. And for the first time in Chinese history, and maybe anywhere, we have private political organizations working against the government.
Wow.
And they do this through images and through writings and things like that. The Chinese hadn't yet invented printing, but so everything was manuscript culture.
Right.
But still, they got a lot of stuff out, and there were student demonstrations. My book covers all this. You know, there were student demonstrations, and then things got more and more violent because basically rule of law broke down. And that first book traces how this happened, and as the people of the time understood it, and if this sounds a bit like what we're going through now, I won't comment, but basically the distinction between public and private had been foundational for Han government. And this, in my second book, I show how that evolved. And what they saw happening by about the second century, middle of the second century, is that starts to break down. And people are getting appointed to offices without any proper procedure. You know, that would be like as if the president were to appoint his daughter to it.
Just for example.
Yeah, something like that. And this is the sort of thing that was happening in the Han. And the officers are saying, what the is going on here? You know, these people haven't gone through the proper procedures. How can you appoint them? And at first it was a war of words and a war of art. And then eventually it got violent and the dynasty collapsed.
Wow.
And no relationship to current
events. In your book on ornament society and self in classical China, you look at ancient examples of decorative arts, for example, bronze wine vessels or mirrors, and you show that different styles can express different concepts of value and of identity and how those relate to the social context. Could you tell us a little bit about how you interpret those different styles?
Okay, yeah. And here again, the amazing thing is that the Chinese, by the 4th century BCE, understood how this worked.
Wow, yeah.
They had a good grasp, an analytical grasp of how it worked. But so the book has two halves, basically. The first part is about the early aristocratic period and how these ritual vessels were used to display and establish social inherited social rank. And in that sense, it worked very much like medieval or early modern Europe, where you make a display of majesty, you make a majestic display.
Right.
And this is absolutely necessary. I don't know if you knew that, you probably know this. Louis XIV spent a lot of time in ceremonies. Ceremonies were very important. This wasn't just a, you know, just wasn't, it wasn't just a pastime. This was how they ruled.
Right.
This was how the state was ruled. And that's how it worked in China up through about the 4th century BCE. About that time, you start to get analytical deconstructions of the system and arguments for what's wrong with it. And then you also start to get bureaucratic theory. And bureaucratic theory is based on the idea that you don't judge people by their group, whether they're noble or common or Chinese or not Chinese or Muslim or Mexican, but just by what they can do as individuals. And so the second half of the book traces that theory and how it evolves and how it gets implemented in the early latter Han. And in my current book, well, when I was researching that, I discovered that Charles Tilly had more or less come, Charles Tilly's a very eminent sociologist, had come to a similar conclusion and articulated it much better, namely that those are the only two options, basically. Either societies are organized by group or by individuals. Yeah. And when they're organized by group, that's basically a traditional aristocratic society, or fascist. Fascism is the same.
Yeah.
I don't know if you probably know this, but people had to wear colored badges under Hitler to indicate which group they belonged to. Just as in medieval England, people had different insignia or clothing to indicate their group, and in medieval China also. So if it's by group, then we don't care what you are as an individual. We just know if you're commoner, then that's all we need to know. Yeah. If you're noble, then you can rule because you're noble, not because you know anything at all about administration or the budget or anything like that. If a society is based on individuals, then you do that by erasing groups, by leaving groups out. And that's basically what the two sides of the book deal with.
So in learning from your work, it's so striking how art objects can tell us so much about the social, political worlds in which they were produced. And I was thinking about how sometimes social and political historians may not always pay close enough attention to art objects and what they can tell us. And I wondered what you thought. Would you say that there are certain kinds of insights about society that we can get from studying objects of art that we couldn't get if we were only looking at the documents and texts and so forth?
Yeah, I think so. And I should say, though, that historians, I think in the last 10 years or so, have started paying much more attention to visual culture. Yeah, in general, most of them don't illustrate that. But I think what's significant about visual art is that it provides a kind of evidence that the documents can't provide. So it's one thing to say, for example, okay, here we have a policy document written in the 12th century that argues that the government should, you know, provide relief to these flood victims. And we have things like that from the 11th century, but then mostly only officials read those documents.
Yeah.
But if you find that in a painting that somebody's carrying around on a fan,
right.
Okay. Then you realize that this notion, this social ideal has penetrated pretty far down the social ranking. So it's, you know, my basic argument is that when a political concept and a political abstraction appears in art, that's a diagnostic feature. That's evidence that this is a constitutive part of political discourse. This isn't just some passing pad or just something that passing or something that you know, just a couple of people at court were talking about. Yeah. It's come down to, so this then becomes a clue. So if you see, for example, in England, in fact, I think it's only until the 1760s, as far as I can tell, that you get prints that are actually critical of the British government. Before that, you have a lot of prints that are critical of the Dutch, Chinese, everybody else is bad. And very much like the New York Times, right? Everybody else is bad. But to get things that are critical of England, you have it in print earlier, much earlier in England. Visually, it doesn't show up till the 1760s. And so that tells you something. That tells you that this is something that the crowd will recognize, that people will recognize this. And so that's significant.
Our guest today is Martin Powers. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about early modern China. Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review. I'm here with Martin Powers, the author of China and England, The Pre-Industrial Struggle for Justice in Word and Image. In your study, you show that an English translation of Confucian writings done in 1691 had a powerful effect on English-speaking philosophers throughout the Enlightenment, down to Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. Can you talk a little bit about where this translation came from and why it was so important in the West?
Yeah, actually, I would say there were several translations. Seven. That was the among the earlier ones, that was very important. And then there's another one in 1736 and 38, came out in two editions and had several editions thereafter, which was also very important. Yeah. So this first one is really, actually, it first came out in Latin. And it a few years earlier, of course, not everyone could read Latin. The Latin was actually translations from portions of Confucius Analects and the Great Learning and other major Confucian texts. But it was the Morals of Confucius in English, which probably had the greater impact because more people could read that. And those are more redactions, but they're pretty accurate. So when I read through it, for example, I can recognize, oh, this is from the Analects, this is from Mencius, this is from the Great Learning. There's even a little bit from Zhuxi in there. In the context of that period, this was radical stuff. Confucius, you know, again, he says a person's social status is irrelevant.
Yeah.
If they have good advice for government, they have good advice for government.
Yeah.
If they can make a good official, then he can be a good official, and so on. And also the notion that there should be feedback from the people. These were all incredibly radical ideas in the 1680s and 90s. One of the most important notions that comes through there is the idea that the purpose of government is to promote the happiness of the people. And that's a leitmotif that appears several times. That shows up again in Lecomte's book on China, which was also very popular. And again, a leitmotif is this notion of government promoting the happiness of the people. Lecomte's text was so offensive to the French nobility that the book was burned because they didn't like these kinds of ideas at all, much less Lecomte talks about meritocracy and again how officials are appointed based on their learning and ability. It has nothing to do with class and so on. The French didn't like that. So they burned it. But the book was very widely read in England. And then even bigger impact was in the 17th, J.B. Duhalde published two big tomes about China. There was a lot of discursive information about Chinese customs, but the most important parts were actual translations. Now, these translations were made by Jesuits. Some of them had already been made in the late 17th century and others in the 18th century. And he translated many things, many primary documents, but the most important was a collection that the Chinese themselves had made of, it's like the Chinese great books. Okay.
Yeah.
It was the most exemplary essays by the greatest statesmen throughout history. And these were first compiled in Song times by private historians. And they were widely read in Song times as a kind of a crib studying for the exam.
Yeah.
So it would be as if you were reading the great books to prepare for the exam. And then Kangxi in the 17th century ordered all these various collections put together into a single book. And that's what the Jesuits translated. The Jesuits figured, oh, this would be useful because this is the best political thinking coming out of China.
Yeah.
And so that got translated. Samuel Johnson read this and said, like, wow. And he wrote a glowing book review. And Samuel Johnson was the most respected writer in England in the 18th century.
Yeah.
You probably know that. So Samuel Johnson said, you should read this book. I know a lot of people read it.
Yeah.
Horace Walpole, for example, for his 17th birthday, got a copy of it. So this was widely read. And immediately, the radical English intellectuals, at that time they were called the free thinkers, started quoting liberally from these texts in order to argue against aristocracy and for meritocracy. Now, this whole chapter, as far as I can tell, has been left out of Western books on England. It's really strange. You know, when we talk about the Enlightenment, we pick up with Rousseau. That's already decades later.
Or
Montesquieu. We start with Montesquieu.
Yeah.
Montesquieu actually was responding to this because these guys were saying, hey, you know, in China, anybody can be an official.
Yeah.
Montesquieu was a baron. He didn't like this idea at all. So he argues against it several times. And he says, no, absolutely not. Commoners cannot actually have office. He says we should follow the Romans, who were, and that was an aristocracy, or the English, another aristocracy. where people are allowed to vote, but by God, don't let them actually have power. And so Montesquieu argues vigorously against this, but these documents were very important, and you can see echoes of them in Jefferson, and most of Tom Paine's major points are in there, and you won't find them in English writings of that period. So yeah, my chapters in this book trace this almost decade by decade.
Amazing. Yeah. These ideas that you've been discussing, as you pointed out, they're perennial, and they seem so full of implication and significance, for us today. I wanted to ask you some questions kind of about how these ideas play out. So for example, you've discussed the choice that the state faces between treating people as individuals or as members of a group. And I thought, well, this would apply in thinking about ethnic groups as well and ethnic minorities. And I wondered if, was the Chinese Empire ruling over different ethnic minority groups and thinking about this as well? Did that come into play?
Yeah, that's good. And thank you for bringing that up. Let me make it clear. The point of this book is not to say the Chinese did it first. And actually, the word influence never appears in the book.
Okay, yes.
I don't see this as a question of influence.
Right.
It's true that English radicals made use of some of these Chinese texts. But I argue the reason they did this is because they were facing the same problems that these guys were facing. So these Chinese statesmen were arguing against privilege. They were arguing against corruption. They were they were arguing for a more egalitarian meritocratic system. And that's what the English were doing. So naturally, they looked at these texts and they said, that makes sense. We're doing this too. But in terms of your other question, the question you just asked, ethnic. Yeah, definitely ethnic is part of it. And there's actually a policy document from the second century BCE that takes on this issue. Should we allow non-Chinese to be statesmen? And it argues absolutely on meritocratic grounds. He says it doesn't matter if they grew up in another country or whatever, this should be allowed. And that was incorporated into the great books.
Yeah.
That particular essay was incorporated into this collection. And there are many others that are completely egalitarian. They say you should have nothing to do with income or class. And so again, when you get to the Tang, I think in the Tang, even in Tang times, which is not particularly meritocratic, about like 1 in 12 chancellors were non-Chinese. And when you get to the Song, Khitans, Muslims all took the exam, the civil service exam. They didn't know if they were Khitan or Muslim because it was anonymous.
Right.
As I mentioned last night, the names were covered, replaced with a number, and then the whole exam was copied with only the number on it.
Yeah.
So the examiners didn't know who had done it, and they couldn't even tell from the calligraphy. You could, in theory, tell from the calligraphy if someone was high class or not.
Right.
But they couldn't because the scribes had copied these things.
Yeah.
So, all the way through. I mean, even the Jesuits, I think, were given some official positions.
Wow. Another aspect of this I was curious about, this history that you describe of the development of ideas of individualism and meritocracy and so forth. In China today, with the Chinese government or Chinese intellectuals, is this sort of a well-known history that's referred to in terms of how to justify the government today and the system as legitimate? Is it well-known?
My sense is that it's not. In fact, their notion of Chinese history comes from the West. Basically, the missionaries told them. The missionaries told them China's always been backward. Wow. China's always been autocratic. And
that's ironic.
Yeah, and that's what they learn in their textbooks.
Amazing.
I know this because I teach in China fairly frequently. Right. I think the reason is that the Communist Party thought this would help them if they could convince the population that everything before communism was garbage.
Right.
Then people would embrace communism. I think it backfired. I think it could backfire. I don't think it's personally that it's a very wise policy for them. But I'm not an expert in modern China, so I don't know. But I think it's fair to say that they don't know much about this. Huh. I've published some things in Chinese. I wrote the essays in Chinese and published them. And some people have read those. And so some people pick up a bit of this from that. But in general, most Chinese in government have no idea of what a rich heritage they have.
I was also thinking about meritocracy and in the context of the United States and so forth, and how this idea of selection by talent and so forth. And I was thinking about examples, let's say I picture someone let's say in Silicon Valley, who's, you know, super brilliant and becomes very successful and very wealthy through their own efforts and brilliance and so forth. And then I think sometimes there's this phenomenon today where such people can sometimes become a little bit alienated from, let's say, ordinary people, maybe even kind of contemptuous of the people who seem less brilliant or backwards or unenlightened. And so I was curious about, within this history of meritocracy, are there examples of brilliant scholars who become frustrated with ordinary people and wish they were more enlightened or something?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's two aspects to it. One is that nowadays, I think meritocracy is very much misunderstood, at least in the blogs that I've read or the op-eds that I've read. People often confuse meritocracy with wealth. It's exactly the opposite. Right. The Chinese specifically excluded wealth, and so did Jefferson, so did Paine. The wealth should not be considered a form of merit. And the reason is, it's that term I mentioned last night. Yeah. That's the term for merit. It's got two parts to it. Yeah. One part is learning and ability, and the other part is public service. Yeah. Without public service, there is no merit. Yeah. So making yourself rich is not meritocratic.
Yes.
There's no merit to that. You're only serving yourself. You're not serving anyone else. Yes. So someone who does that is actually not qualified for office. And Jefferson makes this very clear. His assumption is that only qualified people will even be candidates. And this is why he thought you could leave it up to the people, which gets to the other part of your question. Yes. For example, D'Holbach, Diderot were very depressed about the fact that they're trying to save these people, these illiterate farmers. And the illiterate farmers adore the aristocracy.
Yeah, yeah.
They see these fancy clothes and, you know, they see he's wearing a golden belt or whatever. And they say, wow, this guy is cool. You know. And Diderot goes, no. And Jefferson worried over this, too. And so did the Chinese. You know, in my book, I mentioned this. Lu You was a brilliant poet and statesman and a real liberal, social liberal in the 12th century. And he has some poems where he just shakes his head and he says, you know, poor fools befuddled and bemused, you know, they see their neighbors beaten by the tax collector and they think it's only right. You know, and of course, this is a tendency, right? The conservative rural poor have a tendency to think the government is always right, right? So if someone, you know, is somehow abused by the police, well, the police are right. And it was the same in China. And Lu You is just shaking his head and he's thinking, oh, my God. So you have but that's a little different from the Silicon Valley case you mentioned. That one, actually, I think Imperial China guarded against that because the assumption was that if you're in business, you should not be in government. There's a conflict of interest there. There's an automatic conflict of interest. Wow. And they didn't feel that you needed to prove that someone had actually done something wrong. That's, you know, we put the bar way high.
Right.
So unless someone actually sees you taking money out of the kitty, then you're okay. No, that's not, their standard was more like that that's applied to professors, as you know. So for example, I'm pretty sure at Michigan, I cannot have my son take a class from me. They don't feel they have to prove that I will favor my son. I'm in a situation where the temptation, I could easily fool myself into thinking I was being objective when I wasn't. It wouldn't be fair to the other student. And in fact, I just took a test. We have to do this every few years. Yeah. All professors have to take a test to show that we understand conflict of interest. Apparently, presidents don't have to do that. But in China, that standard was applied to all officials. So if you were in a situation where you could make money off of your official position, i.e. you were a merchant, you weren't supposed to be an official.
This is the Athenaeum Review. Our guest today is Martin Powers, the author of China and England, The Pre-Industrial Struggle for Justice in Word and Image. His visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Confucius Institute at UTD. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.